Gildan Media, a division of Recorded Books, presents Spaceflight, A Concise History, by Michael J. Neufeld, narrated by Mike Chamberlain. Introduction. Spaceflight is one of the greatest human achievements of the 20th century. In 1900, only one or two persons in the world understood that the rocket could make space travel possible. Scarcely four decades later, German V-2 missiles began flying beyond the atmosphere. By 1963, the Soviet Union had launched the first satellites, hit the moon, and put the first man and the first woman into Earth orbit. At the end of that decade, American astronauts orbited and then landed on the moon. U.S. and Soviet robots reached the surface of Venus and Mars by the 1970s, and by 1989, American spacecraft had flown by all eight major planets. Four of those travelers were flung on one-way trips into interstellar space, the first human-made objects to leave not just Earth's gravitational influence, but even that of the Sun. That direct exploration of the cosmos, in tandem with space-based and Earth-bound telescopes, has transformed human understanding of our planet, solar system, and universe. And yet exploration has been far from the only or even dominant reason we have gone into space. The great majority of spacecraft orbit Earth to provide services to or gather information about the planet. Since the 1960s, we have effectively annexed near-Earth space. From the 24 orbit at 22,200 miles, 35,800 kilometers on down, and created a new zone of government and economic activity. What is done there is now essential to daily life, especially in the developed world, by providing global communications, satellite navigation, weather observation, military reconnaissance, missile early warning, earth science, etc. The result is a growing but virtually invisible space infrastructure. For many, the space program is still equated with human spaceflight. Yet astronauts have traveled less than about 400 miles, 650 kilometers, from Earth's surface since the last Apollo lunar mission in December 1972. That is expected to change in the 2020s. But whether that will lead to a vibrant future of moon bases or Mars expeditions is an open question. And while important lessons have been learned in the nearly half century that spacefarers have only been in low Earth orbit, LEO, the rate of technological change and of achievement in human spaceflight pales in comparison to both deep space robotic exploration and near space infrastructure. Thus, one of my primary purposes in this brief overview is to introduce educated lay readers to the full spectrum of activities that we humans have developed in space, and to the effects that has had on consciousness and culture. A history also must describe origins and causes, not just the events and their effects. The human imagination and drive to explore certainly have something to do with spaceflight, but any activity out there costs a lot of money. Early in the 20th century, amateur enthusiasm quickly gave way to international arms races and war as the primary drivers of development. Military and national security missions continue to be a very large part of what happens in Earth orbit. Garnering prestige and signaling technological strength has also been absolutely critical, especially for human spaceflight during the Cold War, but also afterward. And commercial competition and profit entered into the equation in the 1960s, at first only with communications satellites. Late in the Cold War, corporate activity began to expand into other sectors, and by the 2000s, even into human spaceflight. Because nation-states have been the primary actors in this realm, space history is often written as a history of national programs, or of cooperative programs between states. That drives much of the narrative in this book, particularly in the first three chapters, which tell the story of the origins of space ideas and technology, the Cold War space race, and space science and exploration, which is a Cold War byproduct. But transnational movements of people, ideas, and technology have always been part of the spaceflight story and have grown in importance as corporations and new nations have taken on a larger role since the end of the Cold War. In the last three chapters, I discuss growth of a global space infrastructure, military and civilian, the rise of a global astroculture, and the internationalization and privatization of human spaceflight after the Cold War. The global integration of world economies and political systems is the foundation for some of these changes, but spaceflight also impacts the process and rate of globalization by influencing, among other things, the planet's culture and its networks of communication. Barring a civilizational collapse induced by war or climate change, spaceflight appears to be here to stay, in large part because it has become so integral to life on Earth. Whether the human race will expand outward and become a multi-planet species, as spaceflight proselytizers have long predicted, is possible, but uncertain. Whatever happens, spaceflight by machines and humans is an outstanding accomplishment with critical impacts on our lives. It behooves us to understand something of its history. 1. Spaceflight dreams and military imperatives. For millennia, the heavens were the realm of the gods and mythological beings. It was not a place one could imagine traveling to, with the possible exception of the moon, whose visible face made it look like a real world. But even then, there was no non-supernatural way to go there. Creating a technology to escape Earth only gradually became imaginable in the 18th and 19th centuries, with the emergence of balloons, railroads, steamships, and other seemingly miraculous breakthroughs in transportation and communication. Another critical influence was the emergence of modern astronomy in Europe, which turned the moon and the planets into places one could imagine walking on, even if going there seemed to be impossible. Many fantastical and often satirical tales had been published featuring space travel, but none were as influential as those of French writer Jules Verne. His From the Earth to the Moon, 1867, and its sequel, Around the Moon, 1870, like his other science fiction, set a new standard for technological realism. Notwithstanding the fact that the giant cannon he used to propel his spacefarers would have instantly flattened them at the moment of ignition, it inspired dreamers to imagine a flight to the moon and how the problem could actually be solved. One of them was Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, born in 1857, who overcame a hearing impairment to become a teacher in and around Kaluga in Tsarist Russia. In his spare time, he was obsessed with inventing concepts for air and spaceflight. He spent more time on airship concepts than he did on space vehicles, but inspired by Verne, but also by a bizarre Russian philosophy called cosmism, in which the invention of space travel would lead to the perfection of mankind and reanimation of the dead, he also began searching for a way to propel something in a vacuum. By 1883, he realized that the rocket would work. Using rocketry for spaceflight was by no means obvious. The Chinese had invented the black powder rocket around 1100 CE as a spin-off of gunpowder. It became important for fireworks and for warfare, particularly in Asia, and migrated to Europe in the late Middle Ages. Rockets got a second lease on life in the Napoleonic Wars, when the British inventor William Congreve developed iron casings and other refinements that made them competitive with conventional artillery. But rocketry faded again in the late 19th century as rifled barrels allowed much greater accuracy. Again, largely a firework, the rocket had no obvious potential to lift a vehicle to the almost unimaginable velocities required for spaceflight. 17,500 miles per hour for low Earth orbit and 25,000 miles per hour to escape the Earth, at a time when no human vehicle had yet traveled even 100 miles per hour. Moreover, few understood that Isaac Newton's third law of motion, usually stated as, "For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction," as in the kickback of a gun, applied to the rocket. The popular fallacy was that its exhaust jet needed air to push against. To see the rocket's potential, Tsiolkovsky made several imaginative leaps beyond the limitations of black powder. A self-taught amateur scientist, he used recent breakthroughs in chemistry to understand that burning two liquid fuels would greatly exceed its energy output and efficiency. Moreover, liquid oxygen, LOX, and liquid hydrogen would produce the almost highest possible energy output per unit mass of liquid propellants. LOX, with a condensation point of minus 297 degrees Fahrenheit, was first produced in a laboratory in 1883, and liquid hydrogen at minus 423 degrees Fahrenheit in 1898. Tsiolkovsky also used Newtonian mechanics to calculate the acceleration of such a hypothetical rocket, which lost mass as the propellant burned. He was the first to write down the basic equations of rocket motion. Coming out of these calculations, he eventually realized that the limitations of any one device could be exceeded by stacking them, now known as staging. That allowed dead weight to be discarded on the way up, making higher velocities feasible. The eccentric teacher first published his ideas in turgid, didactic science fiction stories in the 1890s and as scientific papers in 1903 and 1911. But his publications were very obscure inside Russia until the eve of World War I and entirely unknown outside it. In the early 1890s, an equally eccentric German inventor, Hermann Genswindt, published his idea for a spaceship, which expelled individual masses to create a form of reaction propulsion. But his science was weak, and his proposal was quickly forgotten. Around 1908, a new, younger group of theoreticians in Europe and America independently discovered many of Tsiolkovsky's ideas. Each of them was convinced that he was the first person on Earth to think of them. The spectacular flights of airplanes and airships in the early 20th century spurred the imagination. If humans could fly in the atmosphere, what about beyond it? In one case, the Frenchman Robert Esnault Peltier, the connection was explicit. He was an important early aviator and aeronautical inventor who began to think about spaceflight as the next challenge. He published a paper laying out some of the theory in 1912, but he could only imagine that recently discovered atomic energy would have to be harnessed somehow to generate the velocities required. He missed the possibilities of the liquid propellant rocket. Of the early spaceflight theorists, two stand out as Tsiolkovsky's equals: Robert H. Goddard in the United States and Hermann Oberth in Central Europe. Oberth was an ethnic German from Transylvania, part of Austria-Hungary until 1918, and Romania afterward. As a 17-year-old student in Worcester, Massachusetts, Goddard became obsessed with spaceflight in 1899 after reading a newspaper serial resetting H.G. Wells's Martian invasion story, War of the Worlds, around Boston. Sitting in a cherry tree in his parents' backyard, Goddard had a vision of a craft ascending to Mars. Such was the quasi-religious nature of the experience that, when the great 1938 New England hurricane knocked over the tree, he wrote in his diary, "Cherry tree down, have to carry on alone." His vision set off a private quest to find a propulsion system that could work in space. In early 1909, he realized it was the rocket, and proceeded to work out all the principles. Shortly thereafter, Oberth, who was born in 1894, reached the same conclusions after being inspired by Verne. Son of a doctor and eventually a medical student, Oberth also made the earliest investigations of the possible effects of weightlessness. Less apparently eccentric than Goddard and Tsiolkovsky, he would end up later in life a full-blown crackpot, writing books about communicating telepathically with aliens. The topic of space travel seems to have attracted rather strange people. For most, it remained either remotely futuristic or completely lunatic. Goddard was one of the few theoreticians who became a successful rocket experimenter. Having survived a near-fatal bout of tuberculosis, he got a Ph.D. in physics and became a junior professor at his alma mater, Clark University in Worcester. He began empirical experiments, including demonstrating that the rocket worked in a vacuum vessel. He experimentally derived how much flash powder would be needed to demonstrate that one of his rockets had impacted the night side of the moon. In late 1916, he wrote to the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., seeking more funding than he could get at Clark. He got lucky. Always very cautious about revealing his grand dream of spaceflight, he argued for his new rocket invention's ability to lift instruments into the upper atmosphere. It fit perfectly with the program of Charles Greeley Abbott, the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory's director, who wanted to measure the sun's radiative output absent the atmosphere. In early 1917, with war raging in Europe, Goddard got a letter promising him $5,000, worth 20 times that much today. When the United States entered World War I, he did tactical rocket work for the Army. After the war, Abbott pressed him to finally publish a paper about his work and ideas. Reluctantly, the secretive Goddard finished A Method of Reaching Extreme Altitudes. Much of it was a dry mathematical treatise on basic principles, but at the end, he discussed his idea for hitting the moon with a rocket carrying flash powder. When the Smithsonian published the pamphlet in early January 1920, it also sent out a press release that included the lunar idea. It provoked an entirely unexpected reaction. American newspapers announced that a respectable college professor was planning to shoot a rocket to the moon, a story that spread around the world. The press stoked rumors that Goddard was imminently going to launch himself. Volunteers wrote to join him on his lunar journey, while the New York Times ridiculed Goddard and the Smithsonian for lacking the knowledge daily ladled out in high schools that rockets needed air to push against. Despite the comic aspects of a method's release, it gave new public credibility to spaceflight and to rocketry as the way to get there. Rise of the spaceflight movement. In Germany and Austria, the chaos and revolution that followed the Lost War obscured the Goddard story. But in 1923, Hermann Oberth published a small book in Munich, The Rocket into Interplanetary Space. He had dropped out of medical school, served as a medic in the war, and then wrote it as a doctoral dissertation in astronomy that the University of Heidelberg refused to accept. It included more advanced ideas about spaceflight technology than anything previously published outside Russia. Oberth, back home in Romania, got lucky too. His cause was taken up by Max Valier, an Austrian pilot and advocate of a popular pseudo-scientific theory that ice made up most of the universe. In 1924, Valier published magazine articles and a book popularizing Oberth's ideas. Nascent space enthusiasm spawned a small movement, with societies forming in Austria in 1926 and Germany in 1927. In the new Soviet Union, the disastrous war, followed by the Bolshevik Revolution and the Civil War, had thrown Konstantin Tsiolkovsky into desperate poverty. He was even briefly arrested by the communists. His pre-war notoriety in popular science works was forgotten. But in 1924, a combination of wild rumors about Goddard and the publication of Oberth's book stirred a revival of his reputation. Russian space enthusiasts seized on him as their homegrown hero. They reissued his pre-war publications, and he wrote more. Others working on spaceflight ideas since before the war came out of the woodwork, notably Friedrich Zander. While the world's first spaceflight society, formed in 1924, quickly fell apart, The utopian climate of early communist Russia fostered space ideas even more strongly than a Central Europe in post-war upheaval. Back across the Atlantic, Goddard did public speaking and wrote articles to counter the press, but mostly he worked quietly on rockets at Clark University, funded by the Smithsonian. His pre-war idea for an improved black powder rocket using cartridges, essentially a machine gun firing blanks, never worked. In 1921, he switched to liquid propellants, which he had carefully mentioned only in the end notes to a method. He chose easily obtainable gasoline and liquid oxygen. After slow progress that began to frustrate Abbott, now head of the Smithsonian, he launched the world's first liquid propellant rocket on a frigid March 16, 1926, in Auburn, Massachusetts. The flimsy-looking contraption flew 184 feet, but he told no one outside his immediate circle and Abbott. Goddard was always tinkering, filing patent applications, and hoping to perfect his rocket before he would reveal it to the world. It was not until a summer 1929 launch provoked a new round of press coverage that he got lucky again. Famed aviator Charles Lindbergh intervened with the Guggenheim Foundation, leading to a new, more elaborate round of rocket development in New Mexico in the 1930s. Knowing almost nothing about Goddard's work, including his liquid propellant experiments, European rocket groups formed around 1930, naively hoping to develop technology that could make spaceflight possible in a very short time. In Germany, a rocket and space fad broke out in 1928 after Max Valier briefly aligned himself with automobile heir Fritz von Opel. Together and separately, they carried out a series of spectacular, if technologically pointless, black powder rocket stunts with cars, rail cars, ice sleds, and gliders. Movie director Fritz Lang, famous for Metropolis, released a spaceflight movie, Woman in the Moon, in fall 1929, with Oberts and a young science writer, Willy Ley, as scientific advisors. Lang lured Obert from Romania to Berlin and then funded him to launch a liquid-fueled rocket for the movie premiere. Obert hired Rudolf Nebel, a slippery ex-fighter pilot and engineer, to assist him, but Obert was a hopeless inventor. After a nervous breakdown, he fled back to Romania at the end of 1929. Nebel secretly secured 5,000 marks from the German army, which had begun looking at the technology, to finish and launch Obert's rocket. Nothing much came of it except some small-scale engine tests in July 1930 that Obert participated in. But that fall, Nebel created Rocketport Berlin in an abandoned munitions dump in the northern part of the city, midwifed by the army. His impoverished experimenter group became the main activity of the Society for Space Travel, which was in decline due to financial bungling and the onset of the Great Depression. In 1931, they launched their first primitive liquid-fuel rockets. One episodic participant was an aristocratic engineering student, Werner von Braun, born in 1912, who had become a spaceflight fanatic after attempting to read Obert's mathematically challenging book as a 13-year-old student. In the Soviet Union, an amateur rocket group formed in Moscow in 1931, and a small solid propellant institution in Leningrad, St. Petersburg, was given an expanded research agenda the same year. Tsonder led the Moscow group, but he soon died. Sergei Pavlovich Korolev, an aeronautical engineer 6 years older than von Braun, became the group's effective leader. In parallel to the German, he would become an indispensable organizer in the military-dominated rocket world to come. In 1933, the Moscow group launched its first rockets, just as it was merged with Leningrad to form the world's first government research establishment for the development of liquid and solid propellant rocketry. It had a close connection to the Red Army. That year also saw the Nazi seizure of power, which, within a year, led to German Army control over rocket development and the end of amateur experimentation and publicity. The military takes over. The consolidation of totalitarian power by Stalin and Hitler and the resultant withdrawal of German and Russian spaceflight enthusiasts from the international scene ushered in 3 decades in which military missile development dominated rocketry. It also disrupted the transnational network that had formed in the late 1920s to spread the gospel of spaceflight through liquid propellant rockets. 2 multilingual writers were central to this network, Willy Ley in Berlin and Nikolai Reinin in Leningrad. Through international correspondence and the circulation of publications, Ley and Reinin linked true believers and experimenters in Europe and in the United States, where the American Interplanetary Society formed in New York City in 1930. As the Germans and Russians became uncommunicative, what was left of the network shifted to the axis between New York and England, where the British Interplanetary Society, BIS, formed in 1933. Ley himself fled Nazi Germany in early 1935, assisted by contacts in the BIS and its American counterpart. For the first few years, he led a marginal existence as a freelance science writer and rocket experimenter in the New York area. Reinin would die in the Nazi siege of Leningrad. The American Interplanetary Society began by carrying out liquid fuel experiments in imitation of the Germans. Its first leader, science fiction writer and public relations man G. Edward Pendray, visited Berlin in 1931 and corresponded with Ley until the latter landed in the United States under Pendray's sponsorship. In the mid to late 30s, the group changed its name to the less eccentric-sounding American Rocket Society, ARS, and stopped trying to fly rockets. Its emergent leadership of young engineers and technicians concentrated on small-scale engine development, which is what they could afford out of their own rather barren pockets. Robert Goddard kept his distance from the New York group, literally and figuratively. Funded by the Guggenheim Foundation, he moved to Roswell, New Mexico in mid-1930 and stayed there until 1942, except for a 2-year interruption in 1932 to 1934 due to the Great Depression's impact on Guggenheim's investments. Contrary to the neglected genius mythology that later grew up around Goddard, he was one of the best-funded scientists in the United States in the 1930s, at a time when private philanthropy still dominated a much smaller science and technology research sector. He made significant advances by 1935, with vehicles that reached near 10,000 feet and velocities of several hundred miles an hour. But his patrons again became frustrated when he never came close to delivering on multiple promises to reach high altitudes with an instrument-laden sounding rocket, as it would be called after World War II. Abbott, Lindbergh, and Harry Guggenheim urged him to seek outside assistance in the late 1930s, notably from a new rocket group led by Frank Molina that began in 1936 at the California Institute of Technology, Caltech, in Pasadena. Goddard resisted. He was incapable of making the transition to leading massive rocket engineering teams, such as those that would emerge under von Braun and Korolev. He remained a tinkerer, determined to work with a handful of men sworn to secrecy. He could claim many liquid-fuel rocket firsts, yet his influence on later technological development would be almost zero. His greatest impact would always be inspiring others to believe in rockets as the way to spaceflight. As Goddard was reaching a technological dead end, a German army team was making fundamental breakthroughs. In late 1932, 2 months before Hitler became chancellor, the army hired 22-year-old Werner von Braun to write a secret doctoral dissertation on liquid propellant rocketry. It was a very small beginning, but soon the project would experience a massive scale-up, thanks to Nazi rearmament money, von Braun's talent, and artillery officers' fascination with a long-range rocket, what we would call a ballistic missile, as a possibly decisive surprise weapon. In 1935, the Army allied with the rapidly rising Luftwaffe, Air Force. In 1936...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?